Hey, and welcome to Unlimited Hangout with Whitney Webb. Today I am joined once again by the one and only Corey Morningstar. Corey is an independent investigative journalist based in Canada and is also a longtime environmental activist. Her work has focused on major issues such as global ecological collapse, the nonprofit industrial complex, imperial wars, and the role NGOs play in promoting or sustaining them. In our first discussion on this podcast, which is episode 6 for those interested, we focused on the fourth industrial revolution and how a lot of what is currently being sold as quote-unquote sustainable development by the ruling class is hardly good for people or for the planet. Today, we will be building on that discussion by covering the efforts of the so-called Global Green New Deal and the complementary agenda known as the New Deal for Nature. We will also be discussing some of the groups, NGOs, and methods behind the latest propaganda pushes related to COVID-19. So welcome back to the program, Corey. It's great to have you.
Hi, Whitney. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So I think most people by now, in the U.S. and Canada at least, and probably several other Western countries, have heard of the Green New Deal to some degree. People like you and I were early critics of these proposals once they went mainstream, going at least 3 to 4 years back in my case. But more recently, there have been efforts to supercharge the push for a global Green New Deal, specifically in the last 2 years or so. So can you talk a little bit about what this is, who's leading this renewed push, and what the implications of this are?
Sure. A lot of people think that the Green New Deal is a newer thing. It's not. I mean, it goes back decades, but in relation to what we see today, it goes back to 2009, where it was made public that basically the UN launching a new green global economy right out of article. Back at that time, in short, we need to make growing green our mantra. And then it talks about in November 2008, G20 leaders expressed their determination to enhance cooperation and work together to restore global growth and achieve needed reforms in the world financial systems. It was recognized at that time that it needed to happen urgently. And this is coming out of the SDG Knowledge Hub in February 19th in 2009. And for those that don't know, the SDGs are the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, also known as the Global Goals. And then in June of 2019, the World Economic Forum actually officially partnered with the United Nations, and they're at the helm of implementing the SDGs, which are actually, although they're presented as things that sound great, you know, eradication of poverty, health, all these different goals that sound very positive, they're actually emerging markets, which, you know, the whole system is basically why we face the ecological disasters and, you know, all the horrible things happening that we see today. So, again, if you go back to this article, 2009, you had the UN Secretary at that time, I believe, is Ban Ki-moon and Al Gore, right, calling for the launching of a new green global economy. And so let me just check a couple things here, pull up a couple of screenshots I have. So that followed the orchestrated financial collapse of 2008. And then if you jump forward to 2019, I believe, I covered that in my series, The Manufacturing of Greta Thunberg for Consent, about the Green New Deal and AOC in the United States congressman. What is her name? I can never remember.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Cortez, yeah. And so basically she was created by, she was found and basically molded into this person to bring this forward by Justice and Democrats. Anyway, it's in my article. And basically that contains factions of connected to Avaaz. And if you go back to 2009, you've got Paul Hilder. You know, those tweets can still be found on his Twitter today talking about the polling that they're doing back at that time on the Green New Deal. So at that time, they're already, you know, trying to figure out how to get the public uptake, how to get the the social license required, you know, for this thing. And for that, you need a lot of marketing and a lot of, it's all language and framing, right? To make it sound good, like it's serving the people when it isn't. Anyway, you jump forward, 2019, AOC now is a big deal. She calls for a Green New Deal in the United States. The following year, you've got Shiva at the C40 Cities Conference announcing a global Green New Deal. Vandana Shiva, you have, We Mean Business, you have Omar, you have AOC, the head of 350.org. You've got them all at C40 Cities, which is Bloomberg and Clinton, right? And they're talking about, again, a global Green New Deal. The year before, again, I'm bouncing around here, back to 2019, you have a huge report, I forget how many hundreds of pages, out by the UN about a global Green New Deal. At the same time, you've got Europe, you've got people connected to the European Union and the World Economic Forum talking about the Green New Deal. So basically what I'm getting at, you can call it the Build Back Better, you can call it Green New Deal, you can call it the Great Reset, you can call it whatever you want, but what it actually is it's all in the same. It's the building of trying to obtain the social license to further continue a whole entire restructuring of the global economy, you know, social restructuring, financial restructuring, like the entire thing restructured to basically secure the ruling class and secure their power and actually not only secure it, but expand it. And so that's what we're seeing from, you know, we're being hit on all sides by different framing, a different language and different campaigns. But it's all for one thing, and it's to ensure the people that have all the wealth maintain it and the people that have all the power maintain it at the expense of the impoverished in the natural world.
Right. So one of these newer groups that launched pushing for a global Green New Deal, I think just launched a couple months ago. It's called the Global Alliance for a Green New Deal. People listening in the U.S. Will be familiar with Ilhan Omar, obviously, who you already mentioned, and she's one of the founding members of this. But if you go to their website, globalgreennewdeal.org, it basically tells you what the Green New Deal is fundamentally about. And, you know, it says it consists of two main strands, right? The first one is the redesign of national and international financial systems. And the second one is significant investments in energy conservation and renewable energies, and specifically policies aimed at altering the way of life in the global north specifically, which is pretty interesting. And so when you consider that this is being done, as you mentioned earlier, is essentially the UN in partnership with the World Economic Forum, and that the World Economic Forum is leading this, the World Economic Forum, you know, the Davos crowd, these are like the ruling class, the richest people in the world. And so they're structuring, they're using this to push through the redesign of the entire global financial system and to enact policies that would otherwise be completely unpopular and unaccepted in the global north. And so this is being marketed specifically through, at least in the West, through progressive politicians under the guise of collectivism. But we've already seen that a lot of these ruling class figures tied to the World Economic Forum's push for this are hardly going to, like, taking on any of the burden that they want the masses to take on here. You have people like Mark Carney, for example, the former top central banker in England, and I also believe in Canada. You know, he's now the UN envoy for climate change. And there's all these quotes of his recently talking about, you know, essentially that private venture capital is going to lead this and all of this stuff, and the bankers are going to lead this, you know, whole green new revolution or whatever you want to call it. And at the same time, you have, you know, billionaires that are promoting a lot of these policies, like Bill Gates, for example. Like, he has multiple homes, he flies on private jets everywhere. He's obviously, like, not in this, what's being framed as a collectivist struggle, right? So it's definitely interesting to see all this, all these different pieces taking place. But I think that there's been a really successful effort to sort of sell it to people under the guise of collectivism, sort of like the way with COVID-19, some countries have framed it in the media as like a wartime effort. Like, we have to get through this together. We have to come together and, you know, share the burden together, while you have a lot of the elites at the same time not following the rules, and they get caught and they don't really, you know, have to have the same type of consequences if they get caught with not wearing masks or dining when they're not supposed to in lockdown, and all of the stuff. And so we're seeing sort of the same thing developing here. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, the whole, that word, that specific word together, I've written about that, right? That's part of the language and framing going back to 2010. We've had a full decade of that together, where we're to join hands with corporate power and those that oppress us, right? But it's not together, right? This is a class war. And I mean, there's so many parallels between COVID and climate, and even that the things that are happening now could never happen without this cover, without the smoke screen of COVID, because people would never accept it. People would never accept the monetization of nature and our natural world, and that the new stewards of nature will be those that destroyed it. People would never accept that happening behind the scenes. We have nuclear. We have, you know, up to right now 300 new nuclear plants being designed. We have carbon capture storage, you know, trillions of dollars being pumped into carbon capture storage. We have trillions of dollars in bailouts that before COVID, no one would have ever, that this would have never been tolerated by society, right? And so we have all this happening behind the scenes. Carney just did this year. He's got net zero pension summit, right? They're looking at, again, I wrote about this a couple of years ago, $100 trillion in the pensions, how to unlock them, how to use that to basically double the global infrastructure by 2040. So, I mean, when you talk about doubling the global infrastructure by 2040, and you talk about nuclear, you talk about carbon capture storage, which is basically we're going to continue burning, but we'll capture, you know, the carbon and pump it down the ground. These are all just emerging markets, and it's all the same old. It's actually worse, because as we've already talked about before, Whitney, now we're going to actually mine the oceans, right? And so the sky's the limit. Everyone knows, or should know, that the more you plunder, obviously, the more emissions you create, the more damage. It's all being under the guise of biodiversity, and yet we're going to actually destroy every aspect of biodiversity in the name of climate. So, like, it's a real, it's real fuckery here with people's minds. And yeah, and what else is Carney doing? There's huge, huge uptake right now in carbon markets happening again. I mean, years ago, there's quite a bit of resistance against carbon markets, but actually that's happening now behind the scenes in a massive way, massive. And I'm not being talked about. I mean, it's actually so convenient that everyone's hypnotized by the whole COVID narrative, and all this stuff is just happening with, you know, no dissent whatsoever, you know, coming up to COP26, the financialization of nature coming up right into that. A big part of this is on the bioengineering economy, biotech. And you have a part of the draft that was just put out last month for, the convention coming up in China in October, where all this is supposed to be basically agreed upon. And part of that document is the digital sequence information on gene editing. This is going to be a huge part of it, right? We're going to actually edit all life, right, to serve like a white supremacist patriarchy. Right? Like, it's this whole thing is very anti-life, anti-human, anti-feminine, right? It is. And, you know, part of this, again, what people aren't seeing is the genetic modification, precision farming, all this biotech with our food, right? With our people, right? And even like the whole vaccine, experimental vaccine, which has not been approved, which I mean, we're part of this huge experiment. This is the launching pad of biotech going forward, which is massive. And so there's a lot not being discussed, again, behind the smoke screen of COVID.
Yeah, that's definitely true. It's definitely served to make every other problem seem minor, though over the course of this year, it's been interesting to see sort of these efforts to sort of link the two, to link climate change and COVID-19. And this was actually sort of foreshadowed. I've talked about this in several interviews that before the World Economic Forum's annual meeting was held. They have something called Agenda Week. And so the initial speech of that was given by the World Economic Forum chairman Klaus Schwab, he essentially said that by the end of the year, which is when COP26, which you mentioned earlier, is essentially taking place, most of the concern globally, i.e. the fear, will have shifted from COVID-19 to climate change by that time. And then a couple months later, you have Bill Gates, who all over the course of last year was just talking about pandemics and pandemic two after COVID-19 and the vaccines and other things, right? He comes out starting to talk about climate change again, and there seems to be like this obvious pivot. There were some leaked videos of CNN's technical director saying that they're going to move from COVID-19 to climate change, which is pretty interesting because it seems like a lot of the tactics that were used to accomplish what has been accomplished under COVID-19 in terms of its psychological impact on people and how, you know, what types of policies and life changes from the top down people are willing to accept are kind of similar to what they, you could argue they had hoped previously to accomplish with climate change, but hadn't been able to. So it seems sort of like an interesting segue. Do you have any thoughts on that?
It's going to be two-pronged, basically COVID and climate together, exactly as you say. I mean, but it's driven by fear and panic and hysteria. And so we're going to talk about climate, and we're going to instill, you know, more hysteria and fear into the populace. But we're not going to discuss the solutions that are actually being put forward, the ones that are not being discussed. I mean, all that's being discussed is basically you have the hundreds of thousands, you know, maybe millions actually, people lobbying for green energy. That is not going to solve, that is not going to mitigate climate change or solve our biodiversity problems. This is only going to make it worse. And so you're right. They are going to use this to push the agenda further. I mean, it's all about basically, there's even a document I just found from July, I believe, that was, I'm going to see if I can find it here. It was written by the Economist Intelligence Unit with Avaaz and the World Economic Forum. I'm going to see if I can find it. They're even calling, I mean, everything is net zero now, net zero pensions, net zero nuclear, net zero everything. But, oh, here it is. They're calling this an eco-awakening, measuring global awareness, engagement, and action for nature, right? And so they're actually measuring how people are reacting to everything, and it's to obtain the social license. I mean, the ruling class is actually terrified. Even though we often feel really powerless, which is understandable, what's going on. In reality, the ruling class is ruling classes are terrified of resistance and a whole and a revolt where they do actually lose their power and their position within global society. So anyway, in this an eco awakening, again, measuring global awareness with the same old players of Oz and everybody else. And this is, you know, like every day they're capturing this data. Can we do this yet? Can we implement the things that we want to at this juncture? Are people prepared to accept it? I mean, this is a huge part of it. So it's priming people, you know, to accept through their fear and anxiety and panic that the media is building, priming them to accept the corporate solutions that are already designed in store waiting in the wings. And this is what Jeremy Hyman's from Avaaz co-founder and the co-founder of Purpose, which is like the for-profit marketing arm of Avaaz. This is what they call new power. right? And New Power, which is, you know, applauded by World Economic Forum, Richard Branson, again, ruling class, billionaires, corporate power. New Power is the ability to channel and harness energy. And they actually say harness energy to get what you want, right? And so if you don't, that means going into groups where there's, you know, angst, dissent, and building bridges with them and, you know, reframing all that to get what you want. So, for example, we can get what we've seen through the Greta campaign. We can get people by the millions demanding that for action on climate, right? It's very, very, you know, that description. It's just do something, right? That's sort of what people are made to demand, do something. We want our politicians to do something, align with the Paris Agreement, like very, very simple demands. We never, you know, we never go into the root causes of all these huge problems that we have. And so basically you can channel all that energy, which they have, to unleash the corporate solutions that will not, like I said, they will not mitigate climate. They will further our ecological destruction. They will further class division. It's all, again, what we've talked about, all to keep everything intact and expand it at the expense of the working class and the peasantry. And so it's very, very clever. Lots of marketing involved. They have, you know, just they put trillions of dollars actually into the nonprofit industrial complex, which serves as an instrument, right, of empire and ruling class. And it's really difficult to work against this in that way, that it's so powerful, right? They're so organized. All this stuff we're seeing now has been in the works for not just years, but decades. But I mean, the histories aren't written, and I think I still believe in people, and I think people are starting to see what's happening.
So you've mentioned DeVos several times, and I know you've mentioned them several times, but I don't know if that many people in my audience are really familiar with them by name. I think it would be helpful maybe if you could give an overview of DeVos and how they're not just involved with this agenda, but also have ties, for example, to Syrian war propaganda, for example, and you know, imperialism, things like that. So any chance you could give a brief overview of who they are and why they're important?
Yeah, I've written a lot about DeVos, but not a lot in the past few years, although I do have pieces that are not finished yet that I will finish at some point. DeVos is really, really embedded within empire and ruling classes. I mean, all the founders have came out of McKinsey. Anyone that doesn't know who McKinsey is, that's a partner is a strategic partner of the World Economic Forum, and it's a founding partner of the World Economic Forum Center for the Fourth Industrial Revolutions that are setting up all over the globe. So McKinsey is very, very important. I mean, in Ontario, McKinsey is actually at the helm of the whole pandemic structure. So we have McKinsey at the helm. And meanwhile, so here's McKinsey, who's supposed to take care and care about our health. And at the same time, this year, they're settling for billions of dollars in their role of the opioid crisis that is ongoing and the deaths of millions of people, right? So just the irony here and what's lost, right, on people is actually astounding. But DeVos, again, they all came out of McKinsey. If you go back to 2007, actually the founder of DeVos, Rikin Patel, he wrote a paper for the Gates Foundation. It's called something like Cellular Savior. And it's basically advising the Gates Foundation, you know, about this huge, massive opportunity coming. I mean, through that cell phone right now, the smartphone is actually the foundation of the whole Fourth Industrial Revolution architecture at this moment in time. That's, you know, it's been said that the Fourth Industrial Revolution will run through the phone, right, as the conduit. For now, I mean, later it will be embedded into humans. There will be different forms that connect us to this whole, you know, virtual existence. But yeah, Vaz is right in there, part of the United Nations. What more can I say about it? From the beginning, they had built a huge audience. I think it was launched in 2007 or 2008 before they were members of, they held different positions within governments, and they were sort of positioned around the world in the global south, these different, attached to the World Bank. Anyway, it's presented like everything, right? It has this beautiful veneer of holistic, you know, like color and sensory. It's people, when they click on these petitions and that, they think they're doing something good. But it, again, it's just branding, right? And I don't know, they've just been really, really instrumental. I mean, even We Mean Business, which is a huge part of all this, they're Callum Grieve, who's the creator of the Climate Group, and he's named as a founder of We Mean Business by the World Wildlife Fund. He is right behind Greta Thunberg and has been since day one, as well as Al Gore's group, the Climate Reality Group, right? Also was in a phone conversation with Greta Thunberg months before she was discovered, you know, quote unquote discovered on the sidewalk with a film crew sitting there to film it. So Vaz has been involved, like, with not only destroying sovereign targeted states, right, such as Libya, countries. They tried to overthrow Bolivia. They were involved in that. They were involved in trying to put a no-fly zone over Syria. They had people in Syria. I mean, Vaz is just one of the worst imperialist NGOs actually in existence. So anyway, yeah, people should see when they see their name, that's a real warning sign. They've been involved with the financialization of nature since the beginning. I mean, you can just find their name behind pretty much everything that the ruling class wants to get into place. They're just all over the place, right? And they're like huge in Brazil now. They're all over in North America. Oh, I think I was talking about We Mean Business. They helped with it. We Mean Business with the 23 million market cap is behind Greta Thunberg. Vaz helped with the creation of that, as well as Greenpeace helped with the creation of We Mean Business. Yeah, so all these NGOs have this green patina, right? They're right part and parcel of everything that's destroying our societies and our biodiversity, our shared environment, the collective, you know, legitimate, like, communities. Like, it's amazing too right now where we really have to join hands together. I don't mean like as in Greenpeace and Avaz. I mean like real people, grassroots communities, just communities in general. We have to fight what is coming. And now they're succeeding and having everyone terrified of one another, right? And we've all become like, you know, dirty contagions, and everyone's in fear of each other. I mean, it's pretty stunning how successful that they are, right, when it comes to colonizing our minds.
Well, speaking of that, I want to go over some of these NGOs because, you know, some like the World Wildlife, I guess it's fund or foundation, I forget exactly, but the WWF, it has like the panda logo, everyone knows it, you know. A lot of people just associate that like, oh, they must be doing good because they have, you know, this extensive decades-long PR about what their organization is, right? But if you look at who leads them, for example, their like president and CEO is formerly worked really closely with Walmart and Cargill, Procter and Gamble. I mean, some of the biggest companies in the world as part of the CFR and all of this stuff. And it's really amazing to see what groups like that work, like what other types of organizations they work closely with. So like another NGO in that category, right, would be like the Nature Conservancy, that people tend to associate with like, oh, they're an environmental organization advancing this, blah, blah, blah. But if you look at who leads them, I think he's still in charge. I'll have to go double check, I guess. But Henry Paulson, Secretary of Treasury under Bush, the guy that threatened martial law if he didn't get a bailout for Wall Street banks. In 2008 is the guy that's in charge of the Nature Conservancy, or at least was until recently if he was taken out. I'm not exactly sure who's leading it now, but as of a year or two ago, he was in charge. And what's wild is so many people just see the logo and just be like, oh yeah, those seem like great guys. But I mean, Henry Paulson, do you really think he's in it for nature? I mean, he's like a longtime Goldman Sachs executive. He was like Secretary of Treasury under George W. Bush and was responsible for horrific policies. It's really amazing that people can continue to associate, these people that are led by like some of the most predatory bankers and like corporate warlords really in the world with wanting some sort of altruistic future and wanting to restore nature and all of this stuff. And one of the groups that the Nature Conservancy and the WWF partner with pretty regularly is actually called Business for Nature. And they if you look at their strategic advisory group, for example, they say, oh, these are representatives from what they call forward-thinking businesses who place protecting and restoring nature at the heart of their business strategies. And then you go and you look through the companies that they're representing, they're like top people from a city, like Citibank, one of the biggest banks on Wall Street, H&M Group, Walmart, Unilever. It's just really crazy that so many, progressives that have consistently in any other circumstance will be like, oh, boo, corporate America, are so easily, convinced otherwise if these people have, the right branding and the right PR for the particular NGOs. And what's really interesting, too, is that this Business for Nature group, it's all about what you were talking about, financializing nature and making it a commodity that these people can, it's all about measuring nature, how to measure nature, and then how to value it and financialize it and make it a commodity. And this is something that is like the least, it's just astounding that we've come to a point where there's so many people who identify as progressives that are essentially supporting these policies.
Yeah. And I mean, they found they don't have to stop at measuring nature. They can actually measure and monetize social capital and human capital as well. So that's been added into the mix. I'm going to see if I can find it right here. So Clive Spash, who's an economist, he writes, human health, education, and population are also to be monetized and treated like man-made capital. Together, three forms of capital, natural, human, and produced, are taken to represent the inclusive wealth of humanity. In this way, all social, ecological, and economic aspects are equated, allowing their aggregation and integration into national accounting systems. Conflicting objectives and interests are assumed commensurable via reduction to monetary equivalents that support financial wealth accumulation. There is no error in this independent report. He's writing about a recent report having been commissioned by the Treasury Department under a ruling Conservative Party. While pricing, trading off, and optimizing our traditional economic fare, the political vision here involves a far-reaching public policy agenda, promoting the total domination of non-financial aspects of life by finance. And so that's what we're looking at. And I just wanted to add about WWF. I mean, the New Deal for Nature came right out of Davos two or three years ago, out of Davos, and who was World Economic Forum, Al Gore, and World Wildlife Fund. So World Wildlife Fund is an integral partner with the World Economic Forum. They created a campaign called Voice for Nature. Greta Thunberg is one of the, there's a video Greta Thunberg promoting the Voice for the Planet. Voice for the Planet. And then they have Jane Goodall, David Attenborough.
The guy that narrates the BBC Nature documentaries, basically, for those that don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so they have the Voice Voice for the Planet. So that is like the sister campaign for the New Deal for Nature. And, you know, you can look at their documents. Oh, we have millions of people, you know, in support of this. People don't even know what they're supporting, that they're supporting the whole, you know, financing the whole, basically financing all life, putting a monetary, price on all life on the planet. They don't know this. They never actually say what this is, right? Just, we need a new deal for nature. We need a global deal for nature. We have to protect nature. We have to save nature, but it's not about that at all, you know? And meanwhile, as Survival International has actually done a great job putting up a campaign against the 30 by 30 campaign, which is like the privatization of 30% of the planet, where more and more indigenous peoples will be removed, you know, furthering the genocide of indigenous people. World Wildlife Fund has been found to, you know, bear a huge responsibility for murder, rapes, torture of indigenous peoples. This is documented. People should follow Stephen Corey on Twitter, right, to learn about this. And when he basically challenges, you know, international NGOs like Greenpeace, how they can possibly support NGO, you know, that is responsible for these horrible, cruel things happening to indigenous peoples to this day. They're silent. You know, he is absolutely ignored. These groups know what they're supporting and they don't care, because that's why they, you know, get the massive salaries and the massive hundreds of millions of dollars in funding, right, to toe the line. So yeah, World Wildlife Fund is one of the worst that there is. I mean, it's just horrific. And it's sad, because their power actually comes from their ability to say, oh, we have all this support. We have all these people that, you know, follow us. People need to, like, stop supporting these NGOs and start supporting, you know, grassroots resistance and communities in your, you know, local communities. Anyway, it's so out of control, actually, that the power that the nonprofit industrial complex now has. I mean, they're more powerful than governments. And then, of course, our governments now are ruled by corporate power as well. So it's, you know, this is like a really volatile place that we find ourselves in today.
So since we've talked mostly about the Green New Deal or the Global Green New Deal, how would you describe the New Deal for Nature to people that aren't familiar?
I guess just that paragraph I read is a really good way to describe it. People can watch more videos by Clive Spash. He's one of the only economists in the world actually telling the truth on it, speaking out against it, you know, calling environmentalists, you know, quote unquote environmentalists, pragmatists. It's the, on one hand, we have the monetization of all life on the planet, right? And then on the other hand, we're going to have the gene editing of all life on the planet that will basically serve humans. Very human, obviously very human centric and just so disturbing. Right? So they think they can make nature better, right? We can make nature serve man, you know, the white European, you know, class structure. So, I mean, it's so depraved. I've been watching in my house, I've been watching every day. I have these huge gardens that I've been working on for years and decades. And anyway, I've been watching a caterpillar. It's gone into a chrysalis and it's going to turn into a butterfly soon. And every day I'm just completely moved and in awe, you know, of that. And to think that these people, these depraved people, think they can do better than that. I mean, that's what this is. This is man's arrogance. And again, to monetize it all, it's actually just sick. So you've got you have the gene editing, right, of crops and every single thing that can be gene edited will be edited to serve, to basically become enslaved to the economic system, you know, controlled by Western countries. And then you've got over here the financialization of nature, where it'll all be monetized. And then you've got another sort of component of it, which is blockchain, and basically the data that all of this provides. So again, like, this is a brand new everything is being restructured. Fourth industrial revolution, restructuring again the whole global economy, and restructuring people's minds to accept and fit into this hostile world.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hostile, right? Like, horrible. I think maybe I mentioned last time, Deloitte actually says, who will survive, who will perish. I mean, that's the type of world we're going into, right? So no, not this beautiful great reset, not this beautiful green world, not this beautiful anything, like a harsh, enclosed world. I mean, we're seeing capitalism contract, you know, we're like in a vice, it's being squeezed. Everything moving up, up, up. Now we have enclosure of the commons, right? We have all this happening and we're fighting with each other, right? Over masks and vaccines and everything, instead of being united against this. So that the ruling class has actually is succeeding in dividing us, when it's never been more important that we become united against the enemy. The enemy is not you and I. The enemy is them. The enemy is the system that we're enslaved in.
So one of the ways that the New Deal for Nature describes itself, it talks a lot about stopping, like completely halting habitat loss and drastically reducing economic activity and things like that. Do you foresee that being used as a way to sort of force people or to justify policies that are aimed at forcing people off of rural properties or even suburban properties and into smart cities?
Well, yeah, I do think that. I do think that's the way it's going to go, basically, with, I think they said by, I read in white paper, by 2050, 80% of the population will live in the cities. So what does that mean for indigenous peoples? You know, so what we see now, it's just like carbon markets in red, you know, where forests now, they've pushed the indigenous peoples out. They've burned down villages, burned down their homes, get them out. Oh, sorry, you can't be here. We're protecting it, right? Well, there's indigenous peoples, 5% remaining on the planet, I believe. They have protected, I think it's around 95% of biodiversity. And so this is just fucking crazy. And it's all, again, language and framing and these campaigns that are fiction, they're storytelling. So yeah, we will be pushing to cities. Indigenous, the genocide of indigenous peoples will be lost. And another thing I think it achieves by basically, you know, protecting and closing, which will be all traded on Wall Street, all this stuff, all these unnatural areas, and visited probably by rich on vacations, made into, you know, tourism for like the super rich to come in and stay in beautiful settings, and that it'll all be for the rich, for their exclusive playgrounds. So in the same way that we don't see industrial livestock, the whole industry, we don't see it. It's kept behind closed doors, behind, you know, there's not even windows in these, you know, massive places where all this, grotesque, all these abuses go on against animals. We don't see it, out of sight, out of mind, everything packaged beautiful, dyed red at the grocery store. You don't get your hands clean. You don't see it. And I think they're doing basically the same way with the energy in that. I mean, now the energy just for the data centers alone, you know, is just way more than aviation ever was. That's already today, let alone in 5 years from now. And so all this land use will, so much of it will have to be, mined and made to hold like massive. I mean, this, everything is at scale. So the scale is actually unimaginable when you see solar farms and wind farms, how it, you know, destroys the lands and how much space it takes up. And to keep for this virtual existence that basically is the fourth industrial revolution, we won't see any of this. We'll all be in the cities. It will all be behind closed doors. What happens to the natural world, we won't see it. It won't affect us. Even our food will be synthetic. So more and more, it's a we're being more and more removed from nature in every possible way. And I think that allows, you know, everything going forward to happen, right? People won't see that. I mean, people are starting to not, you know what I mean?
Well, that happened already in the U.S., you know, for example, with the industrial like meat system, for example, like keeping people, removing people so much from like family farms and, you know, the get big or get out agriculture a push that happened under the Nixon administration and all of that, you know, basically divorced people from their food supplies. So like people just got used to just buying, you know, vegetables and meat and whatever in the supermarket, not really knowing where it comes from. And so you have kids in kindergarten, you know, in the U.S. that like see dirt on a potato or a carrot and they're like, ew, this is gross, you know, not knowing that, like, you know, how those foods are actually grown, because there's just been this so much distance put in, but also like the extreme abuse and maltreatment of animals, livestock and things like that in this sort of industrialized meat production system. You know, a lot of people don't know because it's like totally hidden away and kept away from, you know, out of sight and out of mind, essentially. And so if they can do that with more of it, you know, they've seen it work on I guess you could say on a smaller scale with different aspects. You know, over the past few decades, and that's been successful. And I think also if you look at this through, you know, COVID-19 sort of as conditioning for some of the stuff they want to implement in this regard, you know, like the social distancing between people, keeping people from interacting, keeping people from going outside and having them sort of like locked in their homes, which for most people tend to be, you know, a lot of people don't have yards around the world. There's a lot of people in apartments and stuff like that. You know, so like lockdowns, I know, for example, like a lot of people in Santiago, in the capital of Chile, for example, I mean, they live in like box apartments. The lockdown, you couldn't really even go outside until they changed it a little bit after several months and stuff like that. But that's an incredible way to divorce people from having any sort of, you know, outside existence, and to sort of shepherd people into getting used to a virtual existence. And so you have like the Zoom schools, you know, for kids, and, you know, getting everyone hooked on the screen and all of this stuff. You know, a lot of that has been greatly exacerbated over the course of COVID-19 and really sort of set this up, I guess you could argue. But, you know, it's amazing that they're doing all of this under the guise of protecting nature when this is just to get people out of the way and keep it out of sight and out of mind completely, and have us so distracted so they can do whatever they want with nature, essentially.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I completely agree. I mean, instead of us recognizing that we're part of nature, we'll see nature as the new other, right? And when other life is other, you can do all sorts of horrible things to that other. And so it allows for all kinds of things that are coming. Again, in service to, you know, the rulers that rule everything today. So this doesn't do anything to eradicate poverty. They don't care about our health. They don't care about nature. They don't care about biodiversity. They never have. We can't expect the people that have, you know, destroyed the planet to now come in and save it. And when you read these reports, it's all put on humans. Humans have destroyed biodiversity. Humans, humans, humans. But it's not true. I mean, most of the damage done on the world is done by a very small, most of the emissions is done, you know, are created by a very small group of people. I believe 5% of the global population creates, that's a huge number. So I might not get this exactly right, but it's anywhere from 50 to 80% of the global emissions. Maybe it's even over 90%. it's just like a massive, huge disparity there.
Yeah, it's definitely a small number of corporations, much of which also don't pay taxes and probably wouldn't pay taxes under the new restructuring of this economy anyway, because they can buy all these offsets. You know, that's essentially how carbon markets allow them to wiggle their way out of any sort of responsibility even then. And I think a useful way for looking at this situation that might help sort of pry people that are sort of stuck in this paradigm out of it is to remember back to things like the TPP, for example, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and how there was this push there to essentially eliminate public laws and have them essentially replaced with like offshore corporate courts that corporations could sue and say that a particular government law was infringing on their profit margin, and then that would be decided in offshore courts controlled by the corporations, and they could essentially become the new government that way and restructure things however they wanted. That way, there's obviously like a longstanding effort to have corporations become the new government. And so, you know, what we're seeing with like the World Economic Forum, which is, you know, nominally, they say, you know, they're about advancing public-private partnership. They're leading this hand in hand with like the central bankers, the private bankers. That's who is really like pushing this agenda forward. You just have to look at their track record to know what these people actually plan to do. And it doesn't really matter what they say or how good their PR is or any of this stuff. I mean, you have to look at their actions and not their words. And, I really hope people at the end of the day don't continue to be so gullible about these people and their intentions when it's quite clear that, you know, they clearly view their position, privileged position, and the current status quo as threatened if they actually allow there to be any agency of the vast majority of people. And so they're taking matters into their own hands through, you know, different campaigns, I guess you could call it, to remake society so they don't have to worry about their position in the status quo being challenged anymore, and they can entrench it even further. And I think that's essentially what we're talking about here.
Yeah. And as you basically in your introduction, you sort of nailed it. I mean, we'll do that. We're being basically manipulated to believe, you know, it's sort of some sort of patriotic movement where we'll do this, you know, to save the natural world. We're going to allow, you know, these fascist measures to be in place because, you know, we're patriots, so we're saving the climate and all this stuff. And yeah, it's just again, framing, storytelling, language. It's just so not true. So not true. I mean, most people are held hostage, right? We're enslaved in the system. This is not the system that we created. It's not a system that serves people. Right. So, yeah, anyway, it's getting really frightening. I mean, for them, it's all coming together just as they've wanted it to thus far. That doesn't mean it can't be, that we can't stop it. But this is a long term project that we're seeing now rolled out.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting here, you know, talking about all these different campaigns or crises, is that a lot of the ones that we've been talking about, you know, COVID-19, climate change. But also if you think of things like the war on terror, even the more recent in the U.S. anyway, the war on domestic terror. It's interesting that all of these things have in common is the idea of the invisible enemy. So essentially people can't see the threat. They have to depend on, you know, the authorities, the quote unquote authorities or quote unquote authoritative sources to educate them about the threat and what the threat will do and how it will develop and evolve because people can't see it for themselves. I think that's, these are the types of crises they rely on, because if people were able to, you know, measure and gauge the threat for themselves, it would be much harder for them to manipulate people. So they tend to rely on things that are sort of like, beyond the, sort of where most people operate to a significant degree, so that people have to rely on them for all the information and thus all of the solutions. So regardless of whether, you know, those solutions are needed or not, you're basically placing your trust in these authorities. And if these authorities, right, in the case of, you know, governments around the world, specifically, you know, like the U.S. government, just as an example, has like a horrendous track record of lying about everything, insane wars, doing like all these awful things to governments abroad, covertly and overtly and all of this. And, you know, if these are the people that you want to keep trusting after, you know, things like the war on terror and all of this stuff, you know, to tell you what's what. I mean, I don't really know how to break people, you know, out of that anymore. But, you know, obviously the use of fear is fundamental here and drives people to look to authority to it. But it's just interesting to me to see the commonality here of that the threat or the force or the enemy force or whatever. In a lot of these cases where there's these like sweeping campaigns that change our way of life, take away our rights and all of this stuff, tend to all be about an enemy that the average person can't know on their own, essentially, because they're like invisible.
No, I completely agree with you. I mean, I actually did a couple of threads probably within maybe when this whole COVID thing started on fear and how it's utilized, you know, by the ruling class to further their agendas and how powerful it is. I mean, if you go back even to, I think it was that very same meeting at Davos where Greta was basically introduced to the world at the forum, and that actually was that whole summit was about the fourth industrial revolution, right? Led by Mark Benioff, Salesforce, owner of Time, he's the trustee at the Center for the Fourth Industrial Revolution in San Francisco. If you go back to that, even, you know, if people remember now, our house is on fire. I want you to panic, right? I mean, it's right there. They want us to panic. If we panic, we'll accept their quote unquote solutions, right? Which as we've discussed, will only further our ecological problems, which are severe, right? They're actually severe. I used to write a lot about climate change, and I actually had to change my course of writing because I realized, again, like what the NGOs and the nonprofit industrial complex and in tandem with media had done. They had created a way of thinking that now people are prepared to sacrifice our natural world in the name of climate, right? And you see that with the amount of energy, the amount of global infrastructure, right? Again, doubling by 2040. You see that people now think that's a fix, actually sacrifice our natural world to save climate. It doesn't even make sense, right? And basically that's what's been embraced, this idea that, and so I had to get away from that, realizing that people were no longer, you know, protecting, fighting, right? Nature, like land defenders. No, we're now marching to demand solar and wind and all these things. I mean, a huge part of this, we don't discuss the energy that's being wasted. We don't discuss how few people in the world even today have access to any energy at all. And so there's just so much to this. There's so many layers and layers and layers. But yeah, the fear and panic on the lack of critical thinking, the critical discussion where it needs to be, you know, what do we do with most of our energy? Where's the military industrial complex in all this? Where's imperialism fit into all of this, right? I mean, the Green New Deal, whatever you want to call it, this is an imperial project, right? We further imperialism, we further, enslavement, colonialism on these other countries that have the resources which we need to go forward to build this infrastructure, this global Green New Deal infrastructure, whatever you want to call it. So again, all ties back together. You can't have environmentalism without addressing the military industrial complex without addressing imperialism, without addressing colonialism, without addressing racism, without addressing, you know, there's a lot. There's a lot that comes into this. And so we have to start framing these things ourselves instead of being manipulated into, you know, what you said, believing or accepting the narratives that come from the top down.
Yeah, I mean, we just need to stop trusting these people. Well, I mean, you and I don't trust them, right? And probably most of our audiences don't either. But it's just amazing that you know, how they can, you know, manufacture certain figures, you know, like AOC and Greta Thunberg being among them, right? That then are able to act as vehicles for trust, even though they're sort of like front people, for interests that people wouldn't trust if they were very public about who's behind it, who's behind these policies and agendas, who they are and all of that, you know? So, you know, it's interesting. And another thing, referring again to that January speech that Klaus Schwab gave, you know, he talked about this year specifically as a year about rebuilding trust. And I think that's because they know that trust is so fundamental to the success of their project. And that's why I think, you know, the people that work in this space and, you know, including you are so essential, because we're like chipping away at their efforts to manipulate people into trusting them, which I think is really important. And I think more people, you know, I mean, obviously COVID-19 is a major thing. And I think it's important to talk about the contradictions there and what's being done under the guise of that as well. But obviously the ruling class has moved on in a lot of ways from COVID to climate change. And so I think, you know, these agendas disguised as sustainable development that are actually being led by the banking establishment and groups like this, you know, I think it's time that we start taking a closer look at what they're doing, because they're trying to keep us, you know, focused on the variants and the vaccines and why, you know, talking about those issues are still important. I think that we also need to keep our eye on where, you know, these people are moving and the policies that they're seeking to implement, you know, as we move out of enter the post-COVID era or whatnot, because we don't really know how long they're going to keep going with this thing, I guess, as long as they can, essentially. You know, and we'll see how that plays out. But I think there's obviously other efforts here. And as I mentioned earlier, there are also these sort of like propaganda efforts to sort of link COVID-19 and climate change. So like Eco Health Alliance, I'm sure a lot of people are probably familiar with that. If you're not, you can go back and listen to my podcast with Sam Husseini. They were involved at the Wuhan Institute for Virology, and they're very heavily funded by the U.S. military and also USAID. But they essentially, you know, were very committed to making the zoonotic origin of COVID-19 the official story from the off, as a means of linking it to climate change, by saying that because of climate change, we'll have more, you know, that's what caused COVID-19, essentially, because of, you know, all these issues. And then from there, we'll have more and more and more pandemics of growing severity, even worse than COVID-19 into the future and all of that. And I think that's a key narrative for them to build upon. So it's just kind of interesting how all these different agendas are coming together.
Yeah. So I just want to also, people who are interested in learning more about the New Deal for Nature, which actually continues to be rebranded. Through our work, we've been able to really hurt that brand term, the New Deal for Nature. I work with a couple other people. Geraldine runs the Twitter account No Deal for Nature. I really encourage people to follow that. We try to share a lot out of there. I forget what the latest hashtags are that they're using, but they're always trying to sort of, you know, freshen up the campaign and mislead people with new hashtags once we sort of succeed in exposing what they're doing. So we've been able to have some success, you know, if you can call that success, on that front. So yeah, people could go to that Twitter account. And again, like I said, Stephen Corey, who's the former head of Survival International, which is one of the only NGOs I would actually even trust, that's, you know, that size. He's been like I said, just great. I'm trying to inform people what the 30 by 30 campaign is, led by National Geographic, which Klaus Schwab's daughter has some sort of high position in National Geographic. And it's also in partnership with the, I think it's pronounced Weiss campaign, which is a foundation of some other rich billionaire. Anyway, the 30 by 30 campaign, Stephen Corey has done a great job, you know, educating people what that is, what that holds in store, if that's allowed to happen. So follow him, Survival International. Just great work, you know, like great work, just normal people doing great work. So there is ways, you know, to expose this and build momentum against it.
So where can people follow your great work and support it?
Well, my great work is sort of been suffering a little bit over the past year. My family has been dealing with problems that come, you know, sort of from COVID-19 in Canada, the lack of services. I just have all kinds of family, like a big family crisis I've had to deal with. So I'm still researching, I'm still reading, I'm still trying to get articles done. And when they are done, they'll be on The Art of Annihilation or The Wrong Kind of Green. And in the meantime, right now is sort of a calm period. I'm trying to catch up, get some work done, do some interviews. So I appreciate this one, Whitney. And I've given up on Facebook, to be honest, but I do try to take to my Twitter account every couple of days and just sort of give people an overview of what I've been researching or looking at.
All right, great. Well, I definitely encourage people listening to, you know, if they haven't already, to go and read your Greta Thunberg series and some of your existing work while we wait for some of your newer articles. These things, especially the kind Corey writes, I mean, some people think my articles are long, but you tend to outdo me even in that regard. And in these types of things take a long time to put together, to research and to write. So,
Thanks. Thank you, Whitney. And also, I just want to also plug the Winter Oak blog. They do really good job of getting a lot of information in one place for people to come and see what's going on. And as well, I've been doing a podcast with playwright John Stepling and artist Hiroyuki Hamada a young guy from Sweden, and it's called Aesthetic Resistance. And so we throw around ideas on there once a week and talk about basically what's been happening.
Okay, great. Well, I'd encourage people to check that out as well. I haven't heard of it myself until now, but sounds great. All right. So with that being said, thanks everyone for tuning in.